Okie dokie. I think many of you would have come particularly to see this talk. We have with us the Right Honourable Sir Vince Cable. For many of you, he will need no introduction whatsoever. He's obviously been on the television often. He is key to our political scene. He was former leader of the Liberal Democrats from 2017 to 19, former Secretary of State for Business. He was MP for Twickenham from 97 to 2015 and has been so again since 2017. He was deputy leader of the Liberal Democrats from 2007 to 2015, shadow chancellor from 2003 to 2010, chief economist for Shell. He has lectured in economics at Glasgow University, and I believe his peers freely acknowledge he knows more about economics than most of them have forgotten. He was advisor to the Kenyan government, a former fellow of Nuffield College, Oxford. His books include The Storm, The World Economic Crisis, and What It Means. It's a short, readable book which offers a pretty conclusive diagnostic of the economic situation as it was then. He's since written After the Storm, The World Economy and Britain's Economic Future, which is also extremely perceptive and well worth a look, though, of course, I'm conscious events move forward at a rapid pace, and I'm sure he'd be willing to take any of your questions after his talk. He's also written a novel called Open Arms. I haven't read that, I must be honest, but it looks terrific, and I believe he's going to explore fiction through the lens of politics in his talk. He's also written Free Radical, a memoir about his life. Free Radical and Open Arms are available for sale. I hope you'll buy copies and get them signed while you have the opportunity. And given we are a festival in the best sense of the term, it's important to mention in 2010 he was on Strictly Come Dancing's Christmas special, which was most memorable, and we're delighted that Rachel, his wife, is here with him today. So please can I welcome to the stage Sir Vince Cable. Thank you.
Well, thank you for your very warm welcome. I'm slightly overawed, given the origins of the festival and, you know, great literary figure, and what do I know about it? I'd perhaps just like to start also by acknowledging the fact that I was, I think, originally invited here by Lucy Hill, and I know about the tragedy, and I'd to express my sadness over that. What I thought I would do would be to start off by saying a little bit about why books matter to me. I mean, you might well ask, you know, this guy's is being paid by you to help run the country. You know, what on earth is he doing spending his time reading novels and writing novels? So why do books matter? Then a little bit about Graham Greene. I'm not an expert, but I've read quite a few of his works quite a long time ago. And then something about my own novel and how I thought about it and where it takes us. And then at the end, time permitting and your interest permitting, say a little bit about the current political scene, which I think has a logical connection with the subject, because fiction is actually probably quite mundane compared with the fact that we're now living through. And it is a somewhat bizarre set of circumstances that we're now dealing with. So I'll suggest how I think the future is going to evolve over the next few months and perhaps beyond that. But on the first, I mean, I attach enormous importance to books, particularly works of fiction. I read extensively, as well as I can, and I do that partly to keep me sane, actually. The last 10 years have probably been the most intense and difficult period of my life. 5 years in the coalition cabinet, and then defeat, and then coming back as leader of my party in very difficult circumstances. And, I mean, what's actually kept me going, mentally going anyway, partly I've got a loving marriage, partly I do a dancing once a week, And partly I read a lot of books, a lot of novels. And I think what I have got out of it, and I suspect what many of you get out of it, is that you put your own thought processes aside and get into the mind of somebody else. That's what I feel I'm doing when I'm reading a book. And find that immensely sort of therapeutic. I don't want to go on extensively about my books, but I thought I'd just mention a few of the books I'm reading at the moment, which I commend. You know, I think often people like recommendations. But in the last few weeks, I think my wife and I passed them backwards and forwards to each other, but David Evershoff's 19th Wife, I don't know if anybody's read it. It's a wonderful part fiction, part non-fiction book about Mormons and polygamy in the United States. A rather cheapy thriller, but actually is very thrilling and quite gripping. Catherine Stedman's Something in the Deep. It's one of those things when you want a book to lose yourself in a rail journey. Gita Mehta's Raj, which I'm reading at the moment, just absolutely wonderful. I mean, a great book, not just a good book. And the thing reminds us that so much of good English literature at the moment is generated by Indian writers. I spend quite a lot of time on them. And perhaps a book that relates more to the themes of today, but probably the best spy thriller I've come across for a long time, which is The Spy and the Traitor. It's Ben McIntyre's book, and it's actually not a work of fiction. It's about Gordievsky and the British spy who penetrated the KGB and fled. He's still around, so he may be here for all I know, but he's living anonymously somewhere in Britain at the moment. So that's why I read, and that's why I attach importance to it. In terms of Graham Greene, as I said, I read his stuff a long time ago, and so I'm not really in a position to say anything very insightful about it. It finished, I think, I don't know how many of the Green experts here felt the same way. I felt it ended on a slightly duff note. I think the last book I read was Dr. Fisher's Bong Party, which is the last book, which was, I thought, a bit anticlimactic. But I think, like most enthusiasts for Green, I read most of the classics, the Burnt Out Case and Power and the Glory, Heart of the Matter, Brighton Rock, End of the Affair, and so on. But also, I think that I enjoyed more, though he himself didn't attach so much importance to them, were the entertainments, as he called them, you know, The Quiet American, the Comedians, Honorary Consul, A Man in Havana, The Human Factor, and so on. And what I got out of them, I think, were two things. I think, first of all, this ability to picture interesting, often damaged people in dramas set in exotic locations. And the reason I was able to relate to them, as I read most of this in my younger days, was I lived in Africa, traveled extensively in Latin America, and went to a lot of the places that Green wrote about. And it was the ability to conjure up these characters in these exotic contexts that I found quite absorbing. I mean, in particular, when I was in Latin America, I was responsible in the British Foreign Office for quite a big chunk of Latin America, and particularly Central America, and used to go to these small, rather seedy places, often run by unpleasant dictators, and it was part of my job. I was never in the Secret Service. I wasn't clever enough or discreet enough, but I did get to know our man in Tegucigalpa or our man in Caracas, and you got to, you know, understand what made these people tick. And it was, they were very Green-like characters, you know, who they were. If they'd been top-rank spies, they'd have been sent off to Prague or Moscow or somewhere, but they were left to fester in some little place that nobody cared all that much about. And they would feed to me, you know, bits of intelligence, report of some what some general has said to his mistress, and imagining that somehow the world's tectonic plates were colliding in Nicaragua or whatever it happened to be. And it was that kind of sense of drama and anticlimax and pathos almost about their work, which I think quite moved me and I found quite amusing. And the other sort of aspect of his novels that I really absorbed, and I'm sure you share it, was this ability in a thriller to capture an atmosphere rather than action. I mean, you know, there aren't many guns, or it's not James Bond, but, you know, there is this remarkable atmosphere that's created in his thriller books. And Le Carré is, I think, the only other person I can think of who manages to do that in quite that way. So, in many ways, it was that heritage or that I tried to capture some of that in my own writing. I mean, it sounds very pretentious, I'm not remotely in the same league, but I tried to learn some of those lessons and wrote my first political novel about 3 years ago, and which is on your table here. And it was in recognition of the fact there aren't too many politicians who've written fiction. Nadine Dorris churns out millions of chick flick books, and there are in the past some political novelists. Some of you may have come across Feinberg, who wrote No Love for Johnny, which was a film of the 50s with Peter Finch, very good. And there was a Labour MP called Maurice Adelman, who wrote a series of novels based around the Palace of Westminster. I think the best, from my experience, you may know of others, was Douglas Hurd's Scotch on the Rocks, which had that mixture of being the political insider but also set against real action drama. And I suppose if I characterize my own approach to writing, it was trying to capture that mixture. And what I did, and those of you who have read it or will read it will become aware of it, was to try to split the action between an exotic location, which in this case is India. I had to know a bit about. I had an Indian family before my late wife died, and did a lot of professional work in India and Britain. And it was built around an arms contract between the two. And in the case of India, I tried to create as my leading characters one of these Indian business families, which if any of you deal with India, you will be familiar with. A kind of rags-to-riches, started at the bottom, used a lot of shady, dodgy, sometimes quite violent practices to get up to the top, and now become a kind of urbane international business person pitching up at Davos with children doing MBAs and the rest of it. I don't know whether you've heard of the Ambani family or the Ruyas, who've got big investments in the UK, and if that's the kind of character I was trying to describe at the Indian end. And quite a bit of the setting is in Bombay, with Mumbai it's now called, which is, if you ever know the city, a place of enormous kind of energy and excitement and, you know, really positive things happening, but also has an undertow of corruption and violence and ugliness, and it's the mixture of the two that makes it a very interesting place. And I borrowed some of my ideas about the setting of the drama in Mumbai. There's a couple of books, one a book by called Shantaram, which was written by an Australian convict called Gregory. I've got the name here, I think. Yes, Gregory Roberts, who fled from Australia and hid in Mumbai slumland and got involved in the underworld, and a remarkable depiction of life there. And another book called Sacred Games by a man called Chandra. In fact, my wife and I sat through about 12 hours of a Netflix film, which is the filming of his book, which, again, if you're at all interested in this area, is well worth reading. So part of my drama was set in Mumbai, the Indian end of the arms contract, and the other end, of course, was set here, Westminster, and I chose as my leading character, or two characters in the UK, two women. One was a rising woman MP, because in many ways one of the interesting features of British politics in recent years has been the way in which women have moved from the periphery to the centre of the political stage, and I wrote that before I handed over power to my female successor. And the other was a young woman of Pakistan origin who, as you can imagine, is torn between her heritage and Muslim connection and background and her loyalty and adherence to Britain, the kind of tension that a lot of families have. So my drama was set in that kind of context. I won't tell you what it says. Actually, I think it's evolving rather as I wrote about it, but I got the timeline slightly wrong. The action was set about now and hasn't quite happened yet, but it's the logic's working out. But just two things about it, which I think are particularly relevant. One of which is that there is a background to this book, which is Armageddon. You know, we have these pretty scary things going on with North Korea and Iran, but we don't focus very often on what I'm sure is the most dangerous place in the world by a long way, which is the Indian subcontinent. You've got three extremely well-armed nuclear powers in one place, sitting literally within hundreds of yards of each other on Himalayan glaciers, and violence breaks out periodically. You may have noticed a few weeks ago in Kashmir, and has potential to escalate in a way that there are probably nowhere else on Earth. So the context in which I set the book and in which the real world operates is, I think, genuinely scary. The other thing I tried to work into my book was a moral. I wasn't just writing a story for the sake of writing a story, but I wanted to enclose within it something, a thought-provoking moral dilemma, which in my particular case was about the ethics and practicalities around the arms trade. Because one of the things that I've encountered throughout my political career are issues around Britain's very considerable capability for selling weapons and the extent to which our economy depends on it. I first encountered it when I started my political life in Glasgow. I was a Glasgow City Councillor when I was in my 20s, and to a considerable degree, the economy of Clydeside, of course it's since declined, the shipbuilding's declined, but it depended on Yarrows and the other shipbuilders who made their living exporting, you know, frigates to Argentina or wherever it happened to be. And, you know, we worried about it, but it was bread and butter, and it provided extremely highly paid, good employment for the workforce. So we coexisted with it. I then encountered the problems around the arms trade again when I was in the Foreign Office. I had, as I mentioned earlier, a few years in the Foreign Office dealing with Latin America. And one of our main functions, this was in the mid-70s, was selling arms to oil-rich countries like Venezuela, Ecuador, Mexico. So I got quite heavily involved in the promotional work around that. But there's one episode which, in a slightly trivial way, illustrated the dilemmas here, because one day I got an application which I had to approve across my desk to sell an armored car to Fidel Castro. And I said, yeah, you know, approved. It seems a no-brainer. You know, a few dozen jobs in West Bromwich. You know, it's not going to do any harm. Anyway, my superiors were much more concerned than I was, and said, no, this is a serious problem. But it was quite tricky, so nobody wanted to make a decision, so they passed it up the line, as happens in hierarchies in civil service. And eventually it got to the desk of James Callaghan, who was very troubled by it, found it very difficult to make up his mind, so he sent it off to Kissinger for approval. And Kissinger was Secretary of State at that point, and Kissinger sent it back, saying, look, if you hadn't drawn this to my attention, I would never have known about it. But since you've asked me, the answer is no. And anyway, I then did lots of other things. But when I was an opposition politician in the run-up to the financial crisis, one of the things I had twigged was the extent to which, even under a Labour government, arms exports were a very, very powerful part of our mercantile culture, and in particular Saudi Arabia. I'm not quite sure how it happened, but I think the Guardian newspaper started getting me to ask awkward parliamentary questions about the Al Yamama contract, and the further I looked at it, you know, the worse and worse it got. I mean, there was sort of rampant corruption, not just in Saudi Arabia, but here. And billions of pounds worth of stuff was being laundered in some very, very unsatisfactory ways. But nobody in government or the Tory opposition wanted to lift the lid on it. So, you know, made a fuss about it, but it all continued. But then, ironically, I found myself in government in 2010, and the job I had, which was Secretary of State for Business, and I was also President of the Board of Trade, gave me overall responsibility for arms export licensing. So I was then suddenly become the gamekeeper, having been the poacher for several years. And it was quite a tricky, tricky job to do. How do you balance the ethical and the material interests here? And I didn't quite know how to handle it, but as it happened, the junior minister who was responsible for trade was a man called Stephen Green, who you may have heard of. He was formerly the boss of HSBC, but he came into government as a trade minister. And anyway, we sat down and discussed what we should do, because I felt queasy about it. I originally, in my youth, spent time with the Quakers and signed all kind of documents saying I was opposed to this kind of thing. And then he told me he was actually, although he'd been a banker, was an ordained Anglican priest. And he felt awkward about it as well. So we had a chat and agreed that we had two options. One was to simply wash our hands of it, in which case some aggressive young Tory minister would have cheerfully signed off every arms contract going. Or we could, between the two of us, stick with it and try to exercise some judgments and restraint around it. And I had this job for 5 years, and sometimes I had to blow the whistle. I mean, one of the times was in Gaza, and the most recent case was on the first batches of weapons going to Saudi Arabia for the Yemen conflict, which I did stop temporarily, but you've seen what's happened since. But there are also cases where actually I thought we should be doing more arms sales rather than less. There are a couple of cases in particular. There's a wonderful factory in Belfast at the end of the Falls Road, which makes some of the finest definition cameras in the world. And it's a wonderful place. I've been there, and they've got Protestant, Catholics. Nobody cares. It's just a high tech industry. But when I got into government, I discovered that the Secret Service and the Defence Ministry and other people were stymieing most of their exports on the basis that these cameras might fall into the hands of the Russians or something. So I overruled them and tried to get them to do more, and they did, as far as I know. Oh, there was another case where after the Kursk disaster, we remember the Russian submarines, all the people, the submariners were killed. some clever entrepreneur in Aberdeen developed some new technology for rescuing submariners, and we wanted to sell this kit to the Russians. And I was all for it. It was a totally sensible and humane thing to do. But there was a very strong objection elsewhere in government. You know, we had sanctions against Russia. You know, you can't do this kind of thing. So there were some cases I was pushing for more sales and others I was pushing for less. But I go into that slightly lengthy digression just to explain the moral issue, which I'd put in the heart of the novel. So it is a story. You may or may not think it's gripping, but it is a story. There's a bit of a romance and a bit of drama. But at the heart of it, that I'm trying to surface some of the issues around what you do with Britain's very high dependence on the sale of exports of arms. So that's really all I want to say about my book. I've got about 10 minutes to say a little bit about politics, and then you can take the questions wherever you like. I thought I'd just to start plunging at the deep end, not being too philosophical, but just dealing with the issue about what's going to happen in the next few weeks, because actually what happens in the next few weeks will determine probably where we are for the next decade, and it's massively important. I mean, the way I think about it, I'm not going to say, you know, these people are idiots and these are brilliant and this is right and wrong. I think the best way to deal with it is to sketch the likely scenarios, what could happen as opposed to what should happen. And I think in roughly, there are three possibilities, I think. The first is that the judges on Monday, we think it's Monday that they're going to pronounce, will rule against the government unambiguously. And the government, Johnson and his people, decide to put on a show of defiance and say, you know, we're not going to accept being overruled by this elite of MPs and judges and all the rest of it, and we're just going to do what we want to do. That is possible. I mean, we could find ourselves in 2 or 3 days in that world that, you know, we haven't been in for centuries, of a government at war with its own legislature and the courts. And it could happen. I personally think it's very unlikely. I think, although the Prime Minister gives the impression of being a bit wild, and probably is, I think when they see the enormity of what would be involved in picking a fight with Parliament and the courts, I think they will back off. Because after all, you know, if the Prime Minister can't obey the law, why would the civil service obey instructions? What are the police supposed to do? You know, what are the armed forces supposed to do? And I think the enormity of that will make them back down if that's the position they're confronted with. But that leads to a kind of second scenario, that if they are faced with a bad result, what does he do? He's made this public undertaking never to deliver Brexit after October the 31st and refused to go to the European Commission to tell them for what's the delay. So what would he do? Well, the scenario we're thinking through in Parliament is that under those circumstances, he would have to resign and hand over, probably to Parliament, the choice of forming an interim government, an emergency government, national unity, whatever you want to call it. If that happened, you would probably get some Tory grandee like Ken Clark, probably, somebody who's respected, not controversial, to form an interim government, and they would then request postponement. But the question then arises about what do they do next? You know, where do we take this thing? And I think under those circumstances, we probably finish up in a few weeks' time going back to the issue of having a second referendum, as it's called, people's vote, as a way out. And I think that's one of the ways that could happen. But I think the third scenario, which is actually much more likely, is that Johnson does get a deal. I mean, there is growing speculation around this. It's fairly easy to see how it would happen. Theresa May's withdrawal agreement is sort of dusted down and a few little words changed here and there, and we stop talking about the backstop and call it a special economic zone. The Northern Ireland, the Democratic Unionists fall into line because they haven't got any leverage anymore. The government's lost its majority, so there's nothing, their votes aren't worth anything. And under those circumstances, it's possible that sufficient Labour MPs, many of whom are desperate to get a deal and move on to something else, will actually vote it through. And a lot of them are saying privately and some publicly that's what they will do. A slight variant on that story is that the deal does go through, but subject to a referendum. And there is a substantial body of people, and I'm certainly one of them, my colleagues, I'm pretty certain, who would vote for that. Okay, you have your deal, but you then put it to a referendum with the option to remain, and I think we resolve the issue in that way. And if that were to happen, you'd then have a four-month hiatus while the referendum is conducted, and there wouldn't then be an election until the late spring, probably. So, you know, there are different possibilities. You may have different views. I'm just a politician. I'm just in the middle of it all. And my views are probably no better than anybody else's on this. But I think that's what's going to happen. But perhaps just my concluding thought is that, you know, while we have this day-to-day dramas, you know, big things are happening under the surface. I mean, the structure of politics is changing. I mean, one observation I have just coming from my party's conference is that in the old days, you know, old-fashioned politics was about the Conservatives on the right and Labour on the left and us, a few other people, somewhere in the middle trying to arbitrage policy between the two and trying to be heard with difficulty under our system. But now it's actually very different. There's whole people thinking about politics in a different way. And you've got the Tories in their new form under the right. You've got us on the other side. And then the Labour Party somewhere in the middle, trying to make up its mind what to do. It's to the extent that people are now thinking in those terms, not about old-fashioned left and right, but about new things, about, you know, identity politics is what we sometimes call it. You've got a new kind of political alignment. And this is all connected with something that's happening throughout the Western world, which is a sort of growth of populism. It's a bit of a cheap word. It's not terribly clear what it means, but populism of the left, to some extent, which I characterize as being saying, you know, trying to make 2 + 2 = 5. And there is a bit of that in Britain and the US, but not much else, I think. And the populism of the right, which is much more powerful and has taken root here with, you know, the whole Brexit stuff and Trump in America and Modi in India, to go back to my novel, Le Pen in France, the Northern League in Italy, the Alternative for Deutschland in Germany, these sort of right-wing populist movements are now becoming a different way of looking at politics, and it's why the kind of the left-right spectrum no longer means anything very much anymore. And all this is happening in an environment which is very, very volatile, where parties' fortunes are up and down. I mean, my party has gone from, within a few months, from 7% to 23% or something. Mr. Corbyn's gone from, you know, hero 2.5 years ago to nothing. You know, people's personal standing, party standing, is fluctuating wildly from one time to another. So if you take that mixture of things, you know, the populism, the volatility, the changing way of, in which people define their politics, you have a very different kind of future evolving. But maybe on that note, I should leave it to you. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Vince, for your absolutely incisive commentary, not only on the novel, but also, of course, politics and the ways they intersect and diverge and converge, the ethics of representation, how to make beauty or at least something aesthetically pleasing from what is, for many people, horror, is, of course, something that has suffused political fiction as we know it and in many forms of fiction. And, of course, we need to continue to read, to learn in all the curiosity and gentility and humility that I think you do offer in the course of your explorations, which are done with such sensitivity. In terms of our political situation, I think we will ask the audience. And perhaps if I may ask a short question to begin. I understand that what we are facing now is unheard of, at least in our living memory. I mean, to put things into some perspective, and looking back a little, if you had put a £1 accumulator bet on Leicester winning the league, Brexit and Trump getting in, you'd be £12 million better off, and nobody would put the bet on. But to give some context to where we might go, it seems to me it's almost impossible to predict what's going to happen from moment to moment. What are your thoughts on really how we can constructively do something as people of political conscience?
Well, it's precisely because it's very difficult to predict that it's quite useful to look at the future in terms of scenarios.
Yeah.
That's what I did at Shell, actually. I was responsible for the scenario planning, and if you're a big company and you're trying to look 20 years ahead and the oil price is going like this, how do you plan? And you plan by thinking through different scenarios and how you deal with them. Sure. If they happen. So that's the way I approached it. I think we need to be a bit careful about the world unprecedented.
Right.
Because actually Britain's been in this position before. I was prompted, there was a very good article in the New Statesman, a very good journal, which described the position in Britain before the First World War, which I think we've almost completely forgotten because the war overwhelmed it. But in 1912, 13, you had a Liberal government, Asquith later, and it was then, I think it was Asquith, which was pressing ahead with its Irish policy. It was very, very bitterly divisive, and it pitched the Conservatives, who were then under Bonner Law, against Parliament. Sure. And the rhetoric of the time was all about, Parliament is illegitimate, defying the will of the people. We've got to fight this on this. And Bonner Law actually went to Ireland, to Northern Ireland, to help fund paramilitary organization and Carson's army. This was, advocating violence, advocating a civil war, in effect. It never happened because, we got caught up in the First World War and everybody sort of forgot about it. But the rhetoric, the conflict between the executive and parliament, conservative, liberal, all that stuff was quite similar to today, but worse, actually.
Sure.
So it is unprecedented, obviously, in one sense, but, Britain has had a more volatile and violent history than we sometimes remember.
Over, we'll start with Jonathan, please. You are joined up first. I'll come to you, David, shortly. Thanks.
I'd like to ask a question which may appear technical, but which I think is central to the democratic crisis that we're in at the moment. in the corporate governance of many organizations, whether they're commercial or charitable organizations or whatever, there's usually a regulation that if any change be made to any element of the constitution, changing the nature of that body, there has to be a certain majority, 60-40, 65-35, two-thirds majority, or whatever. In the case of the referendum, as I understand it, such a majority was not applied. We have a 52-48 split, which is statistically not significant. But it's being presented to us by certain politicians as an absolute mandate expressive of the will of the people. Maybe I'm misinformed, but could you please elucidate that?
Yes, it's quite an important argument. The will of the people is the will of the 37% who actually voted for it. Quite a lot of people abstain for good or bad reasons. The issue of thresholds, I don't know whether you heard Cameron's interview a couple of days ago. He acknowledged that this was probably one of the bad mistakes that he made. He made many, but this was one of them. But it's not, I don't think, a totally straightforward problem, because if you remember Scotland, the history of votes on Scottish devolution started in the debate started in the 70s, and Parliament installed a 60% threshold. There was one of my personal friends called George Cunningham who inserted the Cunningham Amendment that they had to get 60%, and I think they only got 57 or something. And that created an enormous amount of resentment in Scotland that they'd actually voted for devolved government and couldn't have it. So they didn't forget and actually came back to it. And indeed it was when Tony Blair, Donald Dewar and all the rest promoted it, it got through with quite a comfortable majority. But that it has been used before. It would give genuine meaning to the idea of the will of the people, because it probably would be then a genuine majority. But it isn't straightforward, because you get people questioning it in both directions.
Thank you. Next, David, please.
Thank you very much. You've presented yourself as both a politician and a novelist, and I'm very well aware that we're gathered here to celebrate a great novelist, Graham Greene. And I'm also aware that I've spent most of my professional life teaching literature at Glasgow University, as it happens. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering whether you feel that Graham Greene, who in many respects is now quite dated and is writing and addressing a world that is of very largely the mid-20th century, on issues that perhaps we've moved on from, whether in fact all this concern we have in a festival for Graham Greene can, through Graham Greene's writings, speak to us at all about the kind of current dilemmas, political dilemmas, that you've also been outlining.
Well, it goes back to this sort of cliche about fact being stranger than fiction, in a way. One of the things I discovered after the publication of my novel was that sales were not taking off quite as brilliant as I'd hoped. I mean, it wasn't a disaster, but it wasn't a great bestseller. And I asked my literary agent what the problem was. And she said, the bottom has fallen out of the fiction market. And the reason that the publishers think it's the case is that the world is so bizarre that people don't find fiction terribly interesting anymore. They just read the newspapers. I mean, I know that's just one person's sort of homily, but there's an element of truth in it, actually. I think when I've got more time, I hope I will produce a sequel that does deal with some of today's events.
Thank you. We've got a person at the front here, lady at the front. Thank you. Thank you, Erin. Thank you.
Something that I was really struck by when you were in your talk was, but you didn't explicitly link, was how far the rise of populism is linked to rampant corruption. And potentially that is the most damaging feature of it. And whether that's something that we really need to be looking out for in the UK at the moment.
Yes, I don't think corruption is amongst the main causes. I mean, it is in some countries. The rise of Modi and his Hindu nationalist movement in India was partly a reaction to the corruption of the Congress coalition that preceded it. But there aren't many countries where that's the case. I mean, Britain isn't a particularly corrupt country. I mean, there was all that stuff around the arms trade, which is pretty awful. But, I mean, in a league table of corrupt countries, we're not by any means one of the villains. And you've had, you know, a rise of populism in countries which are impeccably honest, you know, even by British standards. I mean, countries like Sweden and Denmark, the growth of the Democrat Party in Sweden, it was primarily triggered partly by immigration and reaction to Muslim minority. Denmark, to some extent, the same. You know, these are countries that, you know, where people publicly declare their taxes. You know, it's transparently honest, and there's no corruption that anybody knows of. And Germany is a very honest country, but you've had quite a lot of populism emerging there. So, yeah, corruption's something you do need to worry about, but I don't think it's the primary. And there are many causes. I personally attach most importance to the collapse of economic competence and performance since 2008. I mean, you know, for 50 years, Western economies, including ours, were sort of bumbling along. You know, it wasn't, you know, 2% a year growth. Everybody was getting a little bit better off every year. People just assumed that whether they were Labour or Conservative, they knew what they were doing. You know, it was all, you know, we had our arguments, but they weren't great. And then suddenly, you know, the system collapsed. It just completely collapsed, and particularly in Britain, because of the way the banking crisis operated. People have been hurt. Large millions of people are now worse off than they were before the crisis because of the damage that was done. And, you know, to a lesser extent, these things have happened in other Western countries too. But I think the primary trigger for populism here is the collapse of the economy in 2008 and the financial crisis. Well, in terms of what the eventual outcome is, I don't know. We have been here before. I mean, if you go back into British economic history, you know, there have been successions of financial crises going back to the 17th century, you know, and then the South Sea bubble and all that, and there were repeated bank failures at the beginning of the 19th century. And, of course, we had the 1930s. And all of them were followed by periods of populism and political upheaval. A period of British history people don't reflect on, but at the beginning of the 18th century was one of the worst periods. It was Queen Anne, I think, was on the throne. You know, you had mobs ransacking London. Parliament was sacked on one occasion because the MPs were refusing to do what people wanted to do, which was to put import controls on Indian cloth, which was making a lot of weavers unemployed, or so they claimed. So, you know, you've had economic crisis leading to political turbulence before. I was reading recently about Peel. It's linked to my next book, which is nonfiction. And I hadn't realized that around the middle of the Victorian era, the middle of the 19th century, before Peel's Corn Laws, there were massive riots throughout the UK. People were killed by the police, the army, militia. So, you know, economic distress in the UK has caused political upheavals before. And I guess if we stabilise, then the populism will peter out.
Thank you. We've got a gentleman here. We've then got Richard over here and then Chris at the back. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your talk. It's very enjoyable. And I congratulate you on modifying the Tory excesses while you're in the coalition. But I will own up to my wife and I probably being the only Brexiteers in the audience today, I suspect. One or two things I'd like to say is, the gentleman over there mentioned about democracy, we should have two-thirds majority. Parliamentary system is based on first past the post. That there was a convicted villain in Northampton who was let out of jail and voted in Parliament, and the one vote, her vote, actually carried the no Brexit option off the table. And no deal off the table. I think many people, I will feel, that democracy is going to suffer very badly if we do not, if we give everybody a vote and say we're going to have a referendum. It may be because Mr. Cameron wants to keep his party together, because it has to be resolved, one way or another amongst themselves. But having given the choice to the people, even though it was a fairly small margin of success for Brexit, I feel that should be honoured. If it's a complete disaster, it's not the end of the world. In 10 years' time, we'll have a new government. We'll probably have a new government in a few months' time. If we don't get, I think things are going to get a lot worse. I can remember your good self saying we should cut out usury, banks are too big to fail, and so on. You know, in our own family, we've had people being very nearly bankrupt by the banks, and they seem to get away with it.
Okay, well, just a few points in terms of what you say. I mean, I think maybe you're not, but I think most people's appetite for debating Brexit has diminished somewhat with exhaustion. But just make one point. I mean, I think if we do get this so-called deal, I mean, what it will produce isn't some dramatic collapse. I mean, it's like a slow puncture. Gradually, the investment, peters out. People may not be conscious of it, but it's just a slow deflation of the economy. In terms of the political outcome, I think one of the things that will happen, and we're not talking about it very much, is a kind of democratic revolution. The most unlikely people are now talking about a fundamental reform of the political system. I was at a conference the last few days with a very leading Tory, he's still hanging in there with Johnson, but pretty disenchanted. And he said, look, a lot of my fellow Tories are now talking about proportional representation because the system is broken. It just isn't working anymore. And it's partly the voting system. And we've just got to move over to a model that, where people talk to each other and form coalitions rather than hurl bricks at each other the whole time. So I think a combination of that and the move to radical decentralization are two of the things which could well come out of this mess.
Okay. Gentlemen. Sir Chris, thank you.
Okay, I'm on. Thank you, Sir Vince, for your interesting talk. And I was interested to hear what you had to say about British arms sales, particularly in the case of an armoured car to Fidel Castro.
British arms sales. He's interested in what you had to say about that, particularly the armed car.
I was going to expand slightly. You probably don't know that Graham Greene was interested with British arms sales to Cuba prior to the revolution. He, through a friendly Labour MP, pressured the British government to stop selling arms to Fulgencio Batista months after the Americans had stopped selling arms to his dictatorship. My question is with regards to arms sales. Are there really any what we can call ethics when we talk about arms sales?
So is it possible to have an ethical sense of selling arms?
Well, I'm not in favour of, complete ban, because there are some cases where I think it's perfectly legitimate. countries have to defend themselves, and you know, we make the kit to do it. But it's got to be carefully regulated. And we do actually have legislation in the UK which sets us, it's derived from the European Union. One of the interesting things about Brexit is what's going to happen to it, I don't know. But it sets a series of tests that have to be satisfied before an arms contract can be approved. And much of the approval process is fairly perfunctory. But if you're talking about a country that's a bit dodgy, you know, either a potential adversary or, you know, very nasty, and I put Saudi in that category, but some of our people don't, then there is quite a long process of debate within government as to whether approval should be given. And generally speaking, the Secretary of State for Defence and Business, the job I had, will tend to argue for going ahead with it, but there is a human rights unit within the Foreign Office that will blow a whistle. And the Minister of Overseas Development, DFID, will also say, well, is this actually helping the development of the country? So there is an interplay of interests and arguments in government. I selectively gave you one or two examples, but some of those debates we had around, for example, Gaza, were quite bitter and cut across the coalition at the time.
Okay. We've got time for one, maybe two more short questions. I wonder if we could have some ladies ask questions, please, because we've heard mostly from gentlemen. So firstly, Jean, please. Thanks, Mike. So, okay.
I don't like to have to tell you this, Mr. Cable, but Lucy voted for Brexit. But we didn't. And what I wondered was, you did mention the possibility in the scenario of Brexit of a second referendum. And I wondered if the outcome of that was again to leave the European Union, would the members of your party accept that or not?
Oh yeah, the answer is must be yes. I mean, if you do agree to go through that process, you've got to accept the outcome.
Yeah, I just wondered if there's a you're feeling a bit of discomfort in your party of pushing for you know, to stay within the European Union, when as we had the referendum and the majority was to leave.
No, and if we had another one and the result was the same, you know, we'd all have to accept it and just get on with life. I mean, there's no question about that. I mean, I can't speak for all my colleagues, but I mean, I'm absolutely clear, and I said that unambiguously when I was the leader. You know, the referendum could happen. I mean, I think it's closer now than it's ever has been, actually. And it could happen through two of the mechanisms I've described. And it wouldn't surprise me, actually, if in a month's time Boris Johnson were to say, if he were to realise that the difference between his deal going down and being accepted is attaching a referendum to it, he may well say, OK, I've done my best. You know, you sort it out. So it could well happen.
Yeah, and I would like to hear your party talking a little bit more again about PR. I'm very much in favour of it.
Well, it will be messy. A lot of people will be bad-tempered. I wouldn't say we're going to have riots, I don't believe that. But, you know, there will be a lot of bad-tempered argument. People will make stuff up as they did last time. But given the very, very unsatisfactory position we're in at the moment, there's no other, to my mind, no obvious other way out. You know, you can have a general election, but it will be about other things. It will probably produce a parliament that's not very different from what we have at the moment. We'll gain some seats. Labour will probably lose some. SNP will gain some seats. But the makeup of Parliament isn't going to be vastly different, and it's not going to provide an answer. So I think, actually, whether you like the idea or not, I don't think we've got any alternative.
No. Okie dokie. I think one more quick question, please, Martin. Thanks.
Good afternoon, sir. This is more of an observation than a question. And incidentally, Mike, an observation for you is that I did make money on the success of the referendum and Trump and Johnson. So we did exist.
Is it 12 million?
But an observation for you, sir. I came to a conclusion quite some time ago that a great number of people, don't ask me for a number, but a great number of people don't value democracy and sovereignty, and I know where my sovereignty comes from, don't value democracy and sovereignty as highly as I do. But they're not my enemies. I don't want... They walk the same streets as me. They send their children to the same schools that I send my children. They're not my enemies. But I think it's a great shame that we cannot be more civilized with each other. And I do believe that the lack of civility does rather come from your side of the argument. Well, that's simply an observation that I would say
the opposite, but let's not get into all that. But I would make two very simple points. The first is that we're talking about two different concepts of democracy. There is parliamentary democracy, representative democracy, which is the system we've had for hundreds of years, decades. And then we've got plebiscite system, which is what the referendum introduced. It's a different approach to democracy. I'm not sorry it's wrong, but it's a different definition of democracy altogether. But in terms of civility, I think that there was a big opportunity missed in 2016. I think if the government, it was then Theresa May, had actually come forward and said, look, this is the result, but we want a conclusion from which the minority, the 48%, can get a buy-in. We're going to try for a compromise in which we leave the European Union, but we keep the best features, the single market, the customs union, the European Economic Area. I think most people would have said, okay, let's stop arguing, let's just get on with it. But by drawing red lines, that created the bitterness and the divisions which we're still living with today, I'm afraid.
Okay, I think we'll stop there. Well, I think we found and concluded really on a number of possible hopes, glimmers of positivity, optimism, and some of the liminal tensional space that I'm sure Vince inhabits in much of his working week. Thank you, Vince, for your generosity and your graciousness in coming here and giving a really hospitably kind and generous talk on both fiction and politics. And thank you so much for your grace in answering the questions that so many people have. And of course, we remember Lucy in our thanks again. Thank you very much. Thank you.